Discover insights to boost your business or improve your quality of life right here on the Soar to Success podcast with your host, Pat Altvader.
Dr. Dennis Whaley has changed the lives of literally millions of people. He is the author of 16 popular books, and his audio album, The Psychology of Winning, is the all-time best-selling program on self-mastery. I am beyond honored to have him on the Soar to Success podcast with me today, talking about a new movie he stars in called How Thoughts Become Things. Welcome to the podcast, Dennis.
Oh, thank you, Pat. It's great to be with you. It's very exciting. Look forward to it.
Yes, well, I am thrilled to have a chance to talk to you. So let's talk first a little bit about this new movie that's coming out, How Thoughts Become Things. Tell us the premise of that movie.
Well, you know, it's kind of a next step beyond The Secret, that which was very successful. And Doug Vermeerian, who's very good at films, you know, I especially like his Opus film, but he manages to put a great story behind it so you can follow it. But I think this one, How Thoughts Become Things, really gives you more meat as far as the action behind the law of attraction. So I'm hoping that it gives people something they can bite into and do every day of their lives to practice this and get more of what they want by giving other people more of what they want.
Yes. So I understand that you were involved in the movie The Secret. Tell us about that.
Well, I was. In fact, I met Rhonda Byrne when she had the idea. The idea came out of the old book, of course, The Science of Getting Rich by Wallace D. Wattles. I think her daughter, Skye, gave her the book. And she decided to do a video, actually a TV show, which became a video, which then became a book, which became very, very popular. And now they're doing a Hollywood movie that's coming out later this year on The Secret.
I saw that. Katie Holmes. She's from Toledo, where I live now. She's
going to be
exciting.
That's going to put much more interest in the general public in that. And I think How Thoughts Become Things as a way of really explaining that everything begins with an image or a thought or a feeling or an idea. We all get them. We get them all the time, every day, the epiphany, the idea, deja vu feeling. Oh, I was just thinking of you, that kind of thing. And if we just will take that image, if it's a creative, positive image, and really define it and get to be more specific about it, I think then we can project it out to other people. But I do believe that the law of attraction takes the action of people dealing with each other, not with some mysterious universal vibration out there, but the actual connections between people.
Mm-hmm. And so how are you uniquely qualified to be in that movie and in Douglas's new movie?
I don't know whether I'm qualified, but I'm sure interested because of my background.
Tell us about your background.
Well, I was just, you know, I was raised poor family, World War II, Korean War, radio, became a Navy jet pilot, began to work with prisoners of war, managed to get out of the military and get into helping people, and went from rehabilitating prisoners of war from Vietnam to writing a doctoral thesis on prisoner of war mental attitude as they were by themselves for many years in their cell. And then I managed to get into the Apollo program in terms of mental training, only to find myself later as chairman of psychology for the Olympics. So I guess you'd say that because I've watched Olympians train in their minds, which is better training than you do on the field, because on the field you make mistakes and you fall and get hurt and you get discouraged. But if you play in your mind and practice the right stuff, then you have a better chance of having it internalized and become a muscle memory, or what I call a reflex. So I guess I'm qualified in that I've studied how the brain gets habitual on a certain thought, and how it projects those thoughts, and how other people react to those thoughts. So I'm qualified in that I'm more of a science-based person than I am in a, shall we say, universe mentality-based. I'm more you and I talked when we were trying to begin to do this. I'm the practical pig. I build my house of bricks. They build their house of twigs and straw. And I need to have science behind me to feel comfortable about the law of attraction. However, I really encourage everyone to be open-minded about your belief system, because many things I used to believe were found not to be true. And many of my fears are not really realistic, but they're real to me. And so a fear is a very real thing, but it's only an imagined concept that becomes real to us.
Yeah, absolutely. And so how was it to work on the movie? How was it to work with Douglas?
Oh, it was great. It was great. You know, he's very quick, very bright, very creative. And so he attracts the other people. He had a lot of energy. He has lots of energy, and he's very upbeat, very optimistic. And I think that makes him a great filmmaker as well. So he's very excited. He's going to be introducing this in a premiere, not only in Los Angeles, but in different parts of the world. So there's one in Las Vegas. There's one in Salt Lake City. There's one in London. There's one in, I guess, somewhere in China, but there's also one in London, in the UK, where my relatives are. So I think my British relatives will probably go to the London premiere of How Thoughts Become Things.
Wow, that's fantastic. And so how would you compare that movie to the earlier movie that you mentioned, Opus?
Well, Opus was incredible. And The Secret, of course, was wonderfully mystical. And The Secret hit at a very important time. The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown had been the number one New York Times bestseller, and then Tom Hanks mm-hmm. was in the movie. And suddenly yes. you had this video that explained since the beginning of recorded time, only a few people had The Secret. And so it became kind of the most mystical concept that people wanted to know more about. And people are always searching for something else. So I think the evolution of that, the fact that The Secret and then Opus came out a little after that. And I think this is a little more than Opus because it has more of The Secret's teachers in it. And it has mm-hmm. more of How Thoughts Become Things in it. In other words, more of the brain training concept and just a little less of the mystical, a little more of the what do we do every day kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, will you give everyone just a quick definition of the law of attraction?
The law of attraction to me is the same thing as one of the basic laws of science, almost like Newton's law. For every action, there is an equal and opposed reaction, which to me is called cause and effect. Which mm-hmm. means my rewards in life will be equal to the quality and amount of service I render to someone and something. So I think that the law of attraction means the thoughts and actions and choices that you make and send out through whatever communication means you have at your disposal, social media, telephone, text, email, every person that you meet, everything that you do goes out to people. They listen or in some way connect with what you are talking about. And if they're disposed to, if they want to, if they're motivated, they'll in some way push their thought of what they want and how they can fill what you need. And it becomes a synergistic relationship between the brains of people. And you know how they say it only takes 6 or 7 people to know almost everyone? Well, it's really true.
Yeah,
we're
yeah.
so interconnected now that uh-huh. whatever you think and say and do will come back to you, even though you're not aware of it. It's working through the brains of other people in the universe. And that's what. But the thing, you know, another thing, Pat, is that not only do we attract people who can give us what we want, we have to be careful. Because we can attract people who want what we have to give but aren't willing to pay for it. So in other mm-hmm. words, givers attract takers, but they also attract other givers. So be prepared for the fact that just keep giving and giving your value without necessarily needing something of equal value back every time you have a transaction. Because if you do that, you'll just be a quid pro quo person. In other words, I'll give you something if you give me something. Well, that's the old Roman way. I believe the law of attraction means you give your best because you can't keep it. What good does it do for you to have it? It's only good for you to give it. So you give more in value than you receive in payment. People accept that. They begin to get the feeling of that. They understand that. They get the vibration of that. And they say, this person really is interested and authentic in wanting to help me. And therefore, they're attracted to you because you're giving them value without a condition placed on it. And I think that's one of the greatest secrets of becoming truly wealthy and truly successful is money and knowledge are the same. What good does it do to have them? You can't take them with you. So knowledge needs to be shared and money needs to be employed or spent or invested. And that's why I believe in investing my money and my knowledge, knowing that I can't carry them on to the next world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So I love to read, and I was just reading a book by Jeb Blount called Fanatical Prospecting. And in it, he talked about the law of need. And his whole premise about that was that if you're desperate, and I deal a lot with small business entrepreneurs, so, you know, you're desperate in your business and you need to make a sale, that immediately the law of need repels everybody because they can feel and sense that desperation. Do you agree with that?
I do. Yeah, I actually do. In fact, I've been in the fundraising business. I used to help Dr. Jonas Salk raise money in the post-polio years. And I found that by giving people an exciting thing to invest in other words, if they did something they were really proud of, sure, they got a newsletter, they got their name on the building, they played in a golf tournament, they got a silent auction. But when they were excited about giving rather than just compassionate only, so when you give out of excitement, when you sell out of wanting to give people what they want, rather than doing it because you're desperate for income, I believe people can sense that need. And they're not just repelled. I think that they're less likely to deal with people who are not excited and who are more desperate in their desire to close the sale. You know, when they keep telling you, just sign the order, or they keep giving you reasons to try to overcome your objections, so they use the puppy dog clothes or the alternate clothes or the...
I never could remember all of those.
You should have heard all those clothes are, let's see, they give you the alternate clothes. They say, well, do you need to check with your spouse? And I didn't think you could, I thought you could make this decision on your own. Or why don't you make a little decision and then you can escalate it later? And they give you all these options that you have in order to opt you in. And I guess that's today called the opt-in, if you will. I thought they were talking about building these funnels, and I thought a funnel was something that sucked you up to Oz as a tornado.
Yeah, right.
But a funnel is leading you to escalating purchases to get making it easy for you to get in. So they can hook you on the bid price later. But I think out of desire is why people are motivated. And they're motivated by fear or need, but it's a struggle because motivation by fear makes you feel you have to, or it's either inhibition or compulsion. But rather than be compelled or inhibited, wouldn't it be better to be propelled or ignited? So I'd rather be propelled and ignited than compelled and inhibited.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. So tell us a little bit about the visualization of the POW who was visualizing the golf every day. for five years.
You know, you and your husband are involved in golf. We talked about golf being like life.
Uh-huh.
You only play yourself. Your self-image is your handicap. You take with you what you did on the last hole. You are really, truly in the game of golf, even if you're in a foursome. You're only playing a gallery of one. You're playing against yourself and your mind. And so visualization is being in the picture yourself, your own swing. You're standing over the ball. You're swinging the club. You're not watching yourself, so it's not a movie. So the Air Force Colonel George Hall, four handicapper, usually shot about 76 on a 72-par hole. He practiced his best golf games in his cell. Remember, they're bare feet, black pajamas, can't go outside, can't talk. You're inside the whole time for 5.5 years. So
wow.
He played golf. That was his way of staying involved and staying, shall we say, sane. Played one round of golf in his cell, over the ball, do the swing, second shot, chip on the green, pull out the flag, grab his putter, line it up, break toward the ocean, and he went through the actual motions every day for 5.5 years. And then he came back and played in the Pro-Am, in the New Orleans Pro-Am, and I was there with, and he was playing, he shot a 76, four over to par. He had was atrophied, he needed a golf cart. The news media said, "Wow, Colonel, what beginner's reentry luck after 5.5 years. He said, "Luck, are you kidding? I never three-putted a green in 5.5 years. And they said, "Well, wait a minute. You mean you had a golf course at the Hanoi Hilton?" He said, "No." And he smiled and he said, "In your imaginary golf course, you never miss. You never three-putt. You only one-putt or two-putt. And I've learned from the astronauts and from the Olympians that if you do it right in drill, you'll do it right in life. And practice makes permanent. So perfect practice makes more perfect, but we happen to be practicing our mistakes. And Pat, I'm just like the rest of the duffers. I go out on the driving range and I practice my hook and slice. And then I practice hitting too short, too long, and I sky it or duff it or scruff it. And I spend too much time missing and not enough time pre-playing the right shot and replaying it if I've done it wrong. So I need to rehearse more and keep that visualization, because the brain has trouble distinguishing internalized virtual reality. The more you practice and the more the practice is correct practice, the more it's embedded in your brain and the more you become reflexive, which would be riding a bike instead of falling over, or brushing your teeth up and down instead of back and forth. So when we learn the right swing or the right stuff and we practice it, we do it that way almost the rest of our lives, because we learned to do it correctly in the first place. And that's the secret of visualization, to do it through your own eyes and do it correctly and make sure that a coach has taught you the right stuff, and then practice what you've been coached, but don't practice your mistakes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sounds simple,
doesn't
it?
Go ahead.
If only it were so easy, but it's simple, but not easy, because we have this little voice in the background that says, "Remember what you did last time," or "Whatever you do, Dennis, don't hit it too hard," or "Remember you're going downhill, definitely don't hit it too hard on a putt." Or what if you're going uphill on the green? Don't hit it too softly or you'll come up short. You'll definitely three-putt.
I know. I was thinking a little bit about golf being like riding a bike, because I always say golf, I wish it was just like riding a bike. And then I thought a little bit about riding a bike. And when you're riding your bike and you see people outside in their yard and they're watching you and they wave at you, you don't think, "Oh, those people are judging me."
No,
you're just happy, you know, "Oh, I get to see some people." But when you're on the golf course and you see some people pulling up behind you, it's like, "Oh my God, there's people there."
Well, didn't you mention to me when we were chatting that you shot one of your best rounds of golf when you weren't paying any attention to the game itself, but how beautiful everything was and how wonderful the day was?
Absolutely. Sedona, Arizona.
I know.
Yeah. So I do think that it's our brain. So I have your book, Seeds of Greatness. And there's this quote in here that I really like that says, "It's not what you are that holds you back, it's what you think you are not." And it seems to me that sort of fits with this conversation that we're talking about the mental aspect of golf or whatever it is that you're about to do. Do you think so?
Well, it does because people have habitual low self-esteem. What they do is they base their belief system on the things that happened to their parents because their parents went through things. So their parents have taught them, big boys don't cry, don't get angry at me, make sure you have your sweater on, you'll get the flu, don't run in the street, you might get hit. And so we're taught all these things that are bad. And of course, the media especially, though, bad news sells. Good news is elevator music, and bad news sells. So we put ourselves in a little prison of all the things we think we're not good enough to be, to do, to become, to have, rather than giving ourselves an opportunity to have the talents that we have, whatever we're gifted with, and to give ourselves permission to, shall we say, to try it out. But we already have opted out on the great American dream many times before we graduate from high school because we've been taught that we probably will not be able to do it because of some limitation that we have. So it really is limited thinking rather than limited potential that holds us back.
And so how can we help those high school grandchildren?
Oh, we really need to. And they're getting such a dose of bad news that the problem with them is they're growing up entitled to want to have everything, but they're not empowered because they don't believe that if it is to be, it's up to me. Or they don't necessarily believe that life is a do it with God, for others, to myself project. And maybe they haven't been taught that personal responsibility, the choices that I make, have a logical consequence and reward to each choice I make. So maybe if they step back and thought before, maybe they would not take Hollywood celebrities and people who make a big statement, a loud statement, a beautiful statement, an athletic statement as their role model. And maybe if they would look at a role model as someone most like them or who had been through maybe like them and who was succeeding in something that they wanted to do, and maybe they should latch on to people who've overcome enormous obstacles to become successful. And I think one of the problems is they're being spoon-fed that there's an instant gratification way to get it. And if you can just get a success app on your phone and, you know, and go to a weekend retreat, your worries are over. But there's no elevator to the top. There's only a series of steps that you take. So I think what we need to do is we need to give them a more realistic view that I'm responsible for the outcome, the choices that I make, and I have to live with the rewards or consequences. And that goes back to thoughts become things. That goes back to the fact that whatever you imagine and whatever you create in your mind becomes so intensified and emotional that it's embedded as your reality. So virtual reality becomes the reality that you find yourself living in.
Yeah, so let's talk about habits for a second. So it's your belief
Habits
that
rule
habits
your
are
life.
replaced. Pardon?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I know that because it's just like the hard drive. You don't erase anything on the hard drive. They can find it. Oh, it's there. Everything you have, everything, every history that you, every website you visited, every text that you've made, every tweet that you've tweeted is all in cyberspace, deeply embedded. Same thing with everything you've thought or done. Every thought that you've thought, Everything that you've done is in the hard drive of your brain, and it's there. So you don't erase it. You don't stop doing something. You superimpose on top of the old software program a new software program. For me, it was being on time. I was waitly come lately. I was always late. And people began to resent that, and they said that I wasn't conscious and conscientious enough of their time, and time wasn't as important to me as it was to them. And they criticized and chastised me for being late. So I decided to reverse that. So instead of being waitly come lately or here comes waitly late again, I began to get a new habit of thinking of myself as on time waitly, first to the gate waitly, arriving early waitly, and I began to put into my brain all the sequences of how I would be. So I had a contingency plan for getting to my appointments. I left earlier. I made sure that in case of traffic, I got an alternate route. I even had other plane reservations just in case the mechanical problem with the plane. And I got so good at it that after 6 months, my little R2-D2 in my brain said, hey, this is a new you, huh? We're beginning to be kind of, we arrive early so we can get a good seat, right? And so we can talk to the presenter, and so we can be engaged and interactive. I even got to the point where I would be able to call and tell people in advance I was going to be a little late, but to start the meeting so I didn't have to walk in with an excuse. So habit is a submarine. It runs silent and deep. You don't break them because they're always there. So you override them until finally the buffet table gets stuck way down deep. And instead of chocolate decadence on the buffet table, you have, no, thank you, I'll have a little piece of pineapple or I'll have some fresh fruit, but thank you anyway. In other words, your new habit has become so strong that it overrides the old temptation.
And what's your theory on the 21 days to change a habit?
My theory is that it first appeared in Maxwell Maltz's book, Psycho-Cybernetics, which you and I read a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize that he was a plastic surgeon. Then it takes about 3 weeks for the swelling to go down to see that your new nose is actually not swollen, but it's actually a nicer nose than the one that you thought you would always have. But it takes about 3 weeks for someone to begin to realize there actually is a physical change being made. And I think that became the 21-day change in appearance or change in habit tactic. I think you could begin to learn how to type on a keyboard pretty well in 3 weeks if you did it every day. But I think it would take 6 months so you didn't have to look down at the keyboard. Then it would take a year for you to be able to do it at about 60 to 80 words a minute. And then if you did it for 2 years, maybe you'd get up to 80 words a minute. You'd be like some of these people who can text so fast, they don't even have to look at their cell phone. They're just texting just by, shall we say, embedded habitual software. And so that's what we do. We try 6 months for a start, because we've been like we are for a long time. So remember, you've been like you are for quite a while, so don't expect an absolute, immediate, or even 21-day major change. Expect the change to be felt and to be noticed, but a little at a time, by the inch, mm-hmm. a cinch, by the yard, hard. So give each new habit a year, and you'll own it.
Yeah, and so in the movie, How Thoughts Become Things, are there suggestions of new activities for people to do that kind of fit into this that we've been talking about habits?
Yes. I know both John Azaroth and I talked about what you need to do to train your brain to get a new habit. And so it definitely it requires a certain repetition over a period of time throughout the day. And it takes time. I think that the neuroscience says that you could make some changes in 6 months. But so I think it's a daily regimen. I think it becomes like brushing your teeth and finally becomes automatic, because about 80-90% of what we do is habitual. But mm-hmm. I do believe those things are in the film, and that makes it for me much more practical The Secret was great to get me thinking. And I think this will get us doing rather than just thinking.
Yeah, perfect. And so do you have a morning routine that you do every day that sort of sets up your day?
Boy, do I ever. I certainly do, especially at my age. So I don't have to set an alarm because my inner alarm is automatic, but yeah, about 6:15 to 6:30. About 6:30, it turns me on. I don't wake up to an alarm because that means something bad is happening. So I wake up to my automatic alarm, or then the music comes on at 6:45 if I'm not fresh and ready to go. Lie in bed for 15 minutes, think about what am I going to do with this day that you gave me. Turn around to the edge of the bed, get on the floor. First thing I do is make my bed. Because I've learned from Navy SEALs in my 4 years at Annapolis that you make your bed every morning first thing because they come in and inspect it. And that, if you make your bed, that's the first good thing you've done during the day, and at least you did that right. We had to make hospital corners. We had to make a coin bounce out. So I get up, make my bed, jump on the mini trampoline, which is a rebounder, and I get my cardiovascular system going for about 10 minutes. I get my lymphatic system draining, and then as soon as I do a little of that, I'm a morning person, so I immediately jump in the shower. Cleanliness is next to godliness, so I get clean. I get feeling refreshed. I get dressed as if I'm going to meet someone. I have a power breakfast, fiber-based carbohydrates, lean source protein, some nuts, maybe a soft-boiled egg, maybe some whole grain cereal or a power shake. And then I say to myself, let's look at my two lists. One is BAG, B-A-G, what are my blessings? Thank you for the day. Thank you for my blessings, accomplishments. Thank you for what little I've done. I'm happy about that. And thank you for my goals. So I look at my bag and say, hey, I got stuff going for me. That's my BAG. Then I turn to my ABCs. And my ABCs are just A, action now, B, before the end of the day, and C, can wait. And I take my day and try to hit the highest priorities first because I have more energy for me in the morning. And I know that I'm going to be interrupted many times during the day, but I keep looking back at ABC. And the most important thing I do is four times a day I say, is this what I'm doing right now taking me toward my purpose in life for my loved ones and for my inner circle and to help other people? So I do a priority check to make sure I'm not tension relieving and I'm really goal achieving, that I'm not majoring in minors. And then by the end of the day, I'm able to say, thank you. I got a little done toward my purpose. I'm feeling good. And I go to bed on a happy thought just as I wake up that way.
Wow, that's fantastic. And do you keep a journal like next to you that where you have your bag and your ABCs? Or is it just written on a piece of paper?
Well, no, I do use a journal because I think being able to look at it like a positive diary instead of filling it full of all of my problems, I fill it full of the things that I'm going to do or that I want to do so I can check back. But I do have an ABC list, and I've usually planned the week before, but I've planned the day before by putting my ABCs down. And I try to get as much of the A's done, action now, and before tomorrow, but usually I have to put some of the before tomorrows on next day's list because I've run out of time and I also got interrupted too many times by the emergencies we all have. So just amazing how our calendars are filled with other people's needs.
So true. And so when do you have time for fun?
I have fun all during, that's part of my ABCs. So what's fun for me, I happen to fortunately be in a profession where my profession is fun. So I've never met a scientist who went to work. School teachers have to do some work, and if you're a music teacher, it's because you love teaching music. So I happen to be in a profession that chases my passion, not my pension. So I'm doing what I love, and therefore I lose track of time. And I have fun during the day. But I must say, I do go outside four or five times to make sure I smell a rose, I see a bird, I smell the air, and I make sure that I don't just get involved in work. that I listen to beautiful music during the day. So I do. I am able to write listening to beautiful music. So I can have a twofer there. And I do go outside and make sure I get in the environment so that I can get that feeling that I don't want to be stuck inside.
Nurtured. Yes.
Yep.
Yeah. So one thing I ask everyone who's on the Sort of Success podcast with me are to give me three traits that you see in top achievers. And I know you have a book of like 10 traits, right? If you could narrow it down to the top three, what would they be?
First one, I gave a youth group yesterday, juniors in high school, and they were from all over the area. And I told them that the first thing you have to do in life really is to take a look in the mirror and say, hey, I deserve to be as successful and happy as anyone else, don't I? And the answer is, yes, you do. Success is not the gifted birth or the way you look or your ethnicity or religion or positive parenting. You know, people come from behind to get ahead. Some of the greatest people in the world have come from really awkward backgrounds. So I say, number one, winners deserve to win in advance by believing they're worthy of success. And because they feel deserving, they're willing to spend effort on themselves to develop their potential. So value must be inside before it can be externalized. So they have to have a feeling of value and believing and saying, I'm as good as the best, not necessarily better than the rest. That deserving gives you a passport, gives you a visa, gives you a potential to seek success. Then the next thing you do, of course, is have to say, well, what is my passion? Well, what are my values? Well, what do I have to work with? And therefore, what you do is you dig down and find your great why at whatever age you are. And for me, it was always raised verbally. I like to write. I love to write. Naturally, I love to talk because I'm spending too much time on these three traits. So I deserve to win. I desire to win with this deep passion. And I'm able to put it into some kind of visualization dream where I have it. I have my passion dignified. I have it specified. That's it. So a goal is a dream with a deadline. So I try to get my desires down to things that I can see, feel, touch, smell, taste, get them kind of really materialized. And then I develop discipline, which is the ability to learn and practice. And the word discipline is from disciple. And disciple means somebody you learn from. And we learn by observation, imitation, repetition. So I believe in repeated learning, reading, saying, doing, seeing the positive thing. Deserve to win, desire to win, and have the discipline to carry through the desired outcome on your own. I think those are the big three for me.
Yeah, those are fantastic. Thank you. Great. Well, thank you so much for being with me today. It was just an absolute delight.
It was for me, and I'm sure we'll connect again. And just remember, the law of attraction takes action every single moment of your day. And lo and behold, when you least expect it, the knock on the
voila.
Door will come. It may not be the prize patrol, but there'll be some good news coming your way.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye, and
okay.
Thank you so much.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Soar to Success podcast. For more insights into growing your business or improving your quality of life, visit SoarToSuccessMagazine.com and subscribe to the Soar to Success podcast on iTunes.